From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's called the Hiroshima of the chemical industry, a look back at the world's worst industrial accident in Bhopal, India, 12 years ago today.
What we're looking at is 50,000 people with permanent respiratory or eye damage, neurological damage, and damaged children.
Also, breast cancer, poisons, profits, and prevention.
Our food, our water, and even our air are all contaminated with pesticides and hormones that the National Cancer Advisory Board recognizes will increase the risk of cancer of the prostate, breast, stomach, brain, and lymph system.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Michael DeAndreas and Terrence S. Wilson left their jobs after a price-fixing scandal at Archer Daniels Midland, and now it's looking more certain than ever that they'll wind up in court. Prosecutors are expected today to ask a federal grand jury in Chicago to indict the two recently departed ADM executives on criminal antitrust charges. The Justice Department will seek charges against Andreas, ADM's former vice president, and Wilson, the former head of the corn processing for the Decatur, Illinois company. Andreas took a leave of absence and Wilson retired 2 days after ADM pleaded guilty October 15th to fixing prices in the markets for citric acid, an additive used in food and detergents, and lysine, a high-tech livestock feed additive. New revelations in the Democratic fundraising scandal are followed by fresh promises of Republican-led hearings into the matter. The latest confrontation developed yesterday over a 1993 letter written to President Clinton by Indonesian businessman Mokhtar Riady, who outlined in careful detail what policy positions he thought the newly elected president should take regarding Indonesia, China, and Asia generally. Riady, whose relatives and executives have provided hundreds of thousands of dollars to Democrats, urged Clinton to normalize relations with Vietnam and specifically noted that his company, the Lippo Group, had two managers already in the country exploring business opportunities. Riady also asked the president to maintain China's most favored nation trade status and made an appeal on behalf of the Indonesian dictator Suharto, who wanted to attend an economic summit of major powers in Tokyo. Ultimately, Clinton did reestablish ties to Vietnam, preserved China's trading privileges, and met privately with Suharto. But the White House denies that Riady had disproportionate influence on those decisions. This news from North Carolina. A 14-year-old North Carolina boy is facing criminal charges after admitting he voted in November's election. Ben Weingarten says he registered to vote at a concert last summer. State law doesn't require residents to show any identification when registering, so Weingarten listed his birth date as 1956. He did give his correct name and address. Then he and his father went to their Durham County precinct on Election Day, and Weingarten cast a straight Republican ballot. The boy's father has also been charged on a felony count of helping his son commit voter fraud. The county prosecutor says the right to vote is at the heart of the democratic way of life, and this fraud case deserves serious consideration. So I guess we have to take one more away from the, 49% of the electorate that voted on Election Day. And I thought you might be interested in this. There are a number of pieces in the major papers today on Karen Palmer. Karen Palmer, who we had on Democracy Now! Yesterday, she is an anti-death penalty activist who was raped a year ago, and she's angry about the NBC Dateline piece that's going to air on Wednesday night called Screams in the Night. It's the story about her rape, but she says it completely misrepresents what happened. I thought I'd just read a little excerpt from the New York Times today. It says the producers of Dateline NBC called Karen Palmer the heroine of an hour-long special report tomorrow night, but she's accusing the program of misrepresenting facts and exaggerating the racial aspects of a rape she endured a year ago. And then reading down on in the column, it says, the executive producer of Dateline, named Neil Shapiro, dismissed Ms. Palmer's charges, saying her story was done tastefully and sensitively. She became disappointed with the program, they said, because the producers chose not to allow her to espouse an agenda on behalf of black issues. And then it quotes Mr. Shapiro, the executive producer, and he says, it's mainly about how a victim can affect some change in police policy. And he says, I think it shows that a crusader-type person, even when their views are sometimes misguided, can still do some good. Well, there was no mention in this piece or in the piece of the Washington Post of the response of Dateline NBC to Karen Palmer's question about why throughout it they have a sketch artist who eventually shows a completed composite sketch of her rapist. The problem is, Karen says, it looks nothing like her rapist, and they never showed her the picture. You're listening to Democracy Now! 12 years ago today, the Union Carbide Corporation's fertilizer plant in Bhopal, India, spewed toxic gas, killing 4,000 people and injuring 500,000 others. It was the world's worst industrial accident, and people are still dying and suffering from illnesses related to their exposure to Union Carbide's poisonous gas. That's why the Bhopal disaster has been called the Hiroshima of the chemical industry. Bhopal has also emerged as a classic example of corporate crime that's gone unpunished. Joining us right now to talk about the situation is Dr. Rosalie Bertel. She's an epidemiologist and chair of the International Medical Commission on Bhopal, which has just released a report on the long-term effects of the release of the methyl isocyanate gas 12 years ago. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Bertel.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Why don't we go back? For those who don't have a vivid picture on what happened 12 years ago today, to Bhopal, India.
Well, I think it's very hard to imagine what it was like if you had gone peacefully to sleep and you woke up with a burning sensation in your mouth, your throat, your nose, and people right away, most of them thought of this factory because they had had other accidents prior to this occasion. People tried to run then. They tried to run away from the factory. And unfortunately, the toxic gas cloud was moving away from the factory. So many of them actually ran in the toxic cloud. If they had stayed where they were, they might have survived. They died in large numbers. There were the hospital nearby, which normally holds 1,000 people, had 11,000 people that night. They didn't know what to do with the number of people. Many died just trying to get to the hospital. Also, the animals died. There were dead cows, dead dogs and cats, and I think the panic of the hospital professionals, they took every sheet they could get and they put it outside on the, it was a cement walk going up to the hospital, and they laid people on the sheet outside.
Did the doctors know in the hospital that it was methyl isocyanate that had been released?
No, Union Carbide, when they opened that plant, never registered any of the toxic materials they were using with the local hospitals or police or fire department. No emergency people knew. In fact, it took 3 days for them to find out that in the body this turns into a cyanide poisoning, and they actually had the antidote on hand in the hospital but didn't use it because they didn't know what the chemistry was of this.
Did Union Carbide know that they had this on hand? Did the Indian government know?
Certainly Union Carbide USA knew. And I saw a telegram which they sent to Union Carbide India. And my understanding is that the physician at Union Carbide had panicked to such an extent that he didn't pass it on. But they should have known this before the accident. You know, you can't operate in the middle of a disaster like that and give people knowledge. You have to have that on hand. And what they were handling there was actually a very dangerous pesticide.
We're talking about actually the common name for it or the brand name for the pesticide is 7?
Yes. And it wasn't just methyl isocyanate that was released. There were some 27 to 29 other chemicals that were released. And because of changing wind patterns, some of them, and they also came out at different times from the plant, when you look at what happened to the population, different people were exposed to different gases.
Now, let me ask you something, Dr. Rosalie Bertel. You're an epidemiologist from Canada. You're well known for your research on low-level radiation, and I hope to talk with you about that in a little while. But how did you end up as chair of this International Medical Commission on Bhopal?
The Permanent People's Tribunal, which is the Bertrand Russell Court, these are international human rights lawyers, have been trying to deal with the violation of the right to life and health, which is being threatened by industry and technology. And they held a tribunal in Bhopal, and because they had gotten into the medical aspects of exposure, they asked if I would serve on the as a judge at the tribunal. Excuse me. And so that was when I met with the people there, and it was my impression, it was also obvious from the people, that they wanted doctors, not lawyers. And I don't mean that the lawyers weren't doing a wonderful job, but the difficulty the people had was with the medical after effects, and so they really wanted doctors. And so it was after that that we pulled together an interdisciplinary and international team of people, because we didn't want to look like a research team from Harvard or something that came to study the people. What we were trying to do was to be of assistance to them. So we invited 60 people from different universities and hospitals internationally. About 28 said that they would be willing to go, and from that number we chose 13 with the mix of expertise that we needed.
And what exactly did you find?
We found a lot of structural problems that were making the medical problems worse. For example, people are still going to the emergency room at the hospital. And at the emergency room, you have large numbers of people waiting in line. Some of them are gas survivors, some of them are not. Some have ordinary common colds, and some of them are in serious medical trouble. And so they don't have a system of local community health service that would relieve this congestion at the hospital. Also, because the physicians are sometimes seeing as many as a patient a minute, they're not getting continuity of their medical records, or they're not keeping track of what medicines the person is taking. So at 12 years after a disaster like this, you should have a rational program of medical therapy. You should be getting training in breathing exercises, and you should be getting help with chronic illness, and it's still being treated as acute crisis situation. So there are a lot of things could be done in India to help the people.
Let's talk about responsibility. Let's go back to Union Carbide, the corporation that made the pesticide, whose plant it was. What has happened to Union Carbide? We all remember the CEO of Union Carbide, Anderson. Was it Warren Anderson? There were wanted signs for him. Yes. What has happened to him and the company?
I understand he's in Florida, but he is... never showed up for the court hearing. He's been indicted by the magistrate court in Bhopal on a criminal negligence charge, together with, I believe, eight of the upper management of Carbide. They should have exercised more leadership and control over this subsidiary. The storage, for example, of MIC is not allowed in the United States, and they were storing large amounts of it in India.
In fact, there was a similar plant in Institute, West Virginia, right?
That's
so you,
right.
There's a real case study there of how Union Carbide dealt with the people of India versus the people of the United States.
Well, it's a very dangerous gas, and there had been, even in Union Carbide's own safety sheet, it said people can die from this. So they knew how serious the exposure was. And even if the Indian plant wanted to store it, they were the ones that were the mentors. They were the ones that should have taken the responsibility to say, no, it should not be stored in large quantities.
Well, what about Union Carbide? What is their responsibility today?
Well, to my understanding, they have walked away with paying only what they had in their insurance policy, plus the interest that it gained while it was sitting in an account till they settled it. So they have basically had no penalty.
What do you think Union Carbide should be responsible for today?
You know, what the people would like is for them to say they're sorry. They have never said they were sorry. And from the point of view of human beings whose whole life was turned upside down and who are suffering, you know, for the past 12 years with not much of a future, just to say they were sorry would help a lot. But they certainly have responsibility toward those people. And they're misplaced in what they're doing now, which looks more like they're looking for international acclaim. So, for example, they've opened a hospital there, but you're not dealing with acute illness. And so the people are, even the hospitals that have been set aside for use of the Bhopal victims, you see maybe 60-bed ward with two people in it. So they don't need hospitalization. They need community health clinics, and they need help for chronic illness. And so the people are afraid Union Carbide will go around and say they built a hospital for the people, and it wasn't needed, and it's not helping.
You know, I can't help but think and remember that when you say all they're asking for is an apology, or at least that's what they'd like to start with. A couple weeks ago, we had Elmarine Whitfield on our show, and our listeners may remember who she was, the daughter of Elmer Allen, who was injected with plutonium unbeknownst to him. He was a victim of a guinea pig of a U.S. government experiment, those plutonium experiments they did in the 1940s and 50s. He had his leg amputated. And Elmarine Whitfield said, when I asked her why she didn't participate in the settlement that Hazel O'Leary, the energy secretary, just announced of $5 million to some of these plutonium victims, she said they're doing it separately, and that really what her mother wants is for that apology to come from President Clinton. And she's been waiting by her phone for the last year.
Yes, the people downwind from the Nevada test site who got the fallout for all the atmospheric testing say the same thing. They want an apology because they trusted the government of the United States of America not to do this to them. And it's so on a human level, I don't think there's going to be recovery and healing without some kind of an apology.
The figures in Bhopal are absolutely astounding.
Yes.
500,000 people hurt 12 years ago and 4,000 people killed.
More than that. It's more like 10,000 people killed.
Why don't they have exact figures?
They only counted the people who died in the hospital. And many other people died trying to get to the hospital. They were found dead in their homes. They had mass fires. They took the bodies because they had all the animals and the people, and they burnt them. Sometimes whole families were wiped out, so nobody was there to tell anybody that they had lived. So the numbers, and there were... I think there were 12,000 death claims that came in, but probably about 10,000 is the right number.
There's a corporate crime movement in this country called the corporate charter movement, and they're talking about revoking the charters of those corporations that are irresponsible. And I know there's a movement underfoot to get Union Carbide's corporate charter revoked here in New York State. Do you think that should happen?
I think there has to be a lot of reform for multinationals, and I do think for a serious damage like this, a charter revoking is appropriate. But what I would rather see is an international law that you can't do anything in another country that you would not be able to do in your own country. This is actually an effect for nuclear power plants. You have to have an operating power plant at home of the same design that's gone through an environmental assessment. Canada is right now trying to get around that with the sale of reactors to China. But it's a good principle that it has to be licensable in the parent country.
We're talking to Dr. Rosalie Bertel, an epidemiologist and chair of the International Medical Commission on Bhopal. In just a little while, we're going to talk about breast cancer. There's a new book out on breast cancer, and we're going to talk about that, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Bertel, about the connections between what happened in India and your work around low-level radiation. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who's an epidemiologist and head of the International Medical Commission on Bhopal that has just released its report on long-term results of what happened there. And I was just saying, asking you about the connection between what you see there and your research around low-level radiation.
I would say, as a person working in public health and epidemiology, whenever you find a hazard that is military in origin, it's very difficult to get any action. So your whole nuclear question, uranium mining, all of that is connected with a nuclear bomb. The pesticides, herbicides and defoliants and insecticides were created for the Vietnam War. So you're dealing with military production and military technology. It was designed to kill. It was oriented toward mega death, and we should not be surprised that the watered-down products they tried to sell to consumers are also deadly. I mean, that's why they were made. And so we're building a culture of death. It's an amazing thing, but I think it's the military run wild and producing anything they want that brings about megadeth.
How does your work and your research into low-level radiation fit in here?
Well, you have the same thing. The spin-offs from this whole militarism is deadly. And the victims are voiceless normally. Uranium mining is the indigenous people, or the people of Namibia, or
what do you
Aboriginals.
Mean the people of Namibia?
Well, that's where they do the uranium mining. So their voices
also here.
Yes, but it's the native people's land, and so it's indigenous people. Whether you're in Namibia, North America, or Australia, these people have no voice. The downwinders of the Nevada test site, the Marshallese, and it's even a Kazakhstani sub-community in China where they set off their nuclear bombs, the French Polynesian people. These people don't have voices in New York City and the radio, so some of us have to speak for them. They're real people. They have real families, and I heard so much about family values over the U.S. election that I'm wondering whose family are they talking about, because these things are devastating to families.
I assume you heard about Hazel O'Leary's announcement of a $5 million settlement with plutonium injectees, people who didn't know they were injected with plutonium but were. How do you tie in the government experiments that were done without informed consent with the work that you do?
Well, I think it's a good thing that they're trying to make up for some of the damage in the past, but what I'm concerned about is they're doing it right now. And I would say the HAARP program, for example, in Alaska, the attempts to manipulate the electrojet and the ionosphere, the damage to the ozone layer and the climate change, these are deliberate in many cases.
What do you mean, the electrojet?
Military experimentation with the ionosphere right now. And so they're causing the damage right now by using different kinds of things. And they're apologizing for one they used 30 years ago. I don't buy that.
Is Canada any different?
Canada quietly helps. They just signed a new NORAD agreement with the United States, which apparently covers all the Star Wars program. U.S. is going straight ahead with the Star Wars program. They haven't stopped at all, even though the Cold War is supposedly over.
So what are your feelings today? I mean, you've been doing this research for many decades. Do you see any hope?
Not unless people wake up. And I don't know what it takes to wake up. I thought the weather changes might wake people up. I really go back to the frog in cold water. If you warm the water up slowly, the frog will sit there till it dies. If you suddenly give hot water, the frog jumps out. So it's the warm water that's getting worse and worse and worse, and people are tolerating it. They're changing their lifestyle. They're believing that their underarm deodorant in their refrigerators are hurting the ozone layer. And they're recycling and reusing, which is okay. It's nice. But what they're trying to do is repair major damage, which has been done by the military, to the Earth's system.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up, but I want to now go back to Bhopal and talk about what people can do here in this country, considering the number of people. I mean, you said at the beginning of the show, 50,000 people who continue to suffer in Bhopal, India.
I think they can help, and I would like to see even churches and schools initiate help for Bhopal. I think that would be one way to embarrass Union Carbide, and I saw that happen in Japan. It was the churches in Japan that raised money to help the victims of the Mitsubishi Company in Malaysia because they felt embarrassed at what their multinationals were doing overseas. So I think Americans should take to heart what an American company did in India.
But what can they do? What can churches do?
I think they can raise money for medical care. They can make connections, human connections, write letters. There's a Bhopal support group right here in New York City at 777.
New York City is 212. Do you know the phone number?
Not.
Oh, you're giving the address?
Head. Yeah, it's
777.
It's at the plaza there.
777
United
UN
Nations Plaza.
Suite
3C.
Let's see if we have a number right here in New York for the Bhopal Support Committee.
That's not it.
Well, we'll give it out tomorrow, or if we get it, we'll give it out at the end of the show. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, for joining us. Dr. Rosalie Bertel, an epidemiologist and chair of the International Medical Commission on Bhopal. You're listening to Democracy Now! What do Monsanto, DuPont, and Westinghouse have in common? These three corporations make cancer-causing chemicals as well as the drugs that treat cancer. It's an ironic fact not lost on investigative journalist Leanne Chlorphine Kasten, author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. In her book, Leanne Chlorphine Kasten charges that 70% of breast cancer may be due to environmental pollution, yet the EPA refuses to ban commercial toxic incinerators, and the American Cancer Society focuses on treatment instead of prevention. I talked to Leanne Chlorphine Kasten just a few days ago and asked her to describe the basic premise of her book around what causes breast cancer.
Well, first we have to say one more thing. There really are some legitimate risk factors involved with breast cancer. And if we put all those risk factors together, and I feel we have to mention perhaps the issue of not having children, that can be a factor. There are other issues of perhaps too much alcohol, which all are related, by the way, to estrogens in your body. But if we put all those normal risk factors together, what you fundamentally have is only 30%. of women getting breast cancer. There are 70% of the women out there who are going to be getting breast cancer, and that 70% is directly correlated to the environment. And I would like to be able to read something to you. In 1994, industry released more than 1.1 billion pounds of toxins linked to human reproductive disorders. Only 1% of the 70,000 different synthetic chemicals and metals in commercial use is monitored. Then I will go on to tell you that our food, our water, and even our air are all contaminated with pesticides and hormones that the National Cancer Advisory Board recognizes will increase the risk of cancer of the prostate, breast, stomach, brain, and lymph system. But if we eat the fruit and vegetables that the American Cancer Society advises will reduce our risk, we may indeed increase our risk by consuming chlordane, dieldrin, toxaphene, and other pesticides. So let's now get into the issue of the environment. A group of chemicals called organochlorines. Notice chlorine. They mostly are chlorine-based. Create such well-known commodities as DDT, PCBs, and dioxins. And these are the chemicals that are now being found as potentially causing some of our cancer epidemic. It's a scary thing because we are exposed through our food, through our air, and through our water. A lot of the stuff that's getting sprayed in terms of herbicides and pesticides contains some of these things. And although we banned PCBs and DDT, they're very toxic, very persistent, and they don't disappear from the environment for a very long time. They also have a tendency to get stored in the body fat of living things. This includes fish, meat, and humans.
The way the PR machine works for a lot of these polluting companies is to raise questions, and particularly to say, well, yes, there are these pollutants in the environment, all the things that you say, but some women don't get cancer. And it's not our fault that some are more vulnerable than others.
Yes, to some degree that's true. But if you deal with things like dioxin, you're talking about the destruction of the immune system. There are many studies identifying that alone. The EPA itself came up with a reassessment of dioxin in 1994. It found that, among other things, the dioxin can mess up your immune system, can mess up your reproductive system, and a number of other systems, and that indeed cancer is part of the problem, but it's not the only problem. So not everybody is going to be equally affected, to be sure, but it certainly makes many women and men vulnerable. That's the issue.
What about the industry's response and how you think health activists should respond to it?
Well, first let's go back a little bit, okay? The International Joint Commission is a treaty body between Canada and the United States to oversee the health of the Great Lakes. They have enormous power to conduct studies and to find for various pollutants that are, you know, ruining, literally ruining the Great Lakes in many ways. And they came up with a decision which was rather remarkable. Most of the commissioners on the IJC are very conservative men and women. Several years ago, they were all appointed by Reagan Bush. They have been extremely effective fundraisers for the Republican Party. They got involved with the International Joint Commission. They started commissioning these studies, and they found that these toxic persistent chemicals, fundamentally the chlorine-based chemicals, are so dangerous that they finally decided to put out an alarm and call for the immediate sunset, the immediate phasing out of chlorine as an industrial chemical. Now, industry did not take this lightly. Dow Chemical is the largest producer of chlorine in the world. They did not like this. So instead of saying, you know what, there might be some value in some of these studies, what industry has done is two things. They've denigrated the studies, and then they have established million-dollar funds to hire PR people to tell us how important it is for us to have not only chlorine in our environment, but plastics. And plastics cannot be made without the use of chlorine. So what we're talking about today is a massive public relations industry that is gearing up for not only ads, we're talking about advertising as well, that are gearing up to let people know that we cannot live without these products. Therefore, what industry has done is literally confuse the public, and it's very hard for little books like mine to get the kind of to have the kind of force that that is needed when I am bucking literally the enormity of the power of these polluting corporations that hire million-dollar ads and million-dollar public relations campaigns. I have in my book a major public relations campaign identified by the Chlorine Chemical Council, how they work their magic, how they identify key people, how they identify the press. All of this goes into making the public complacent and certainly unaware.
Leanne, explain that, because I think this is an illuminating case study for people to understand how the whole corporate machine works, from the industry that pollutes to the corporate PR.
Well, the Chlorine Chemical Council literally got together and created an entire list of to-dos as to how literally to diffuse the IJC and its recommendations. And they've had meetings. They've had all kinds of experts in the PR industry coming in to talk to how to do all this misinformation. And we're talking serious misinformation here. Identify key people in the media who will be very willing to take our side rather than the environment side. And by the way, it worked. May I tell you that for the last three biennial meetings of the IJC, they have put out again another call for the phase out of chlorine in industry. And for example, our Chicago papers have barely picked it up. It is definitely not on the cutting edge of any media reporting. And therefore, what we have to ask is why? And let's take, for example, the Chicago Tribune. We have a newspaper that bleaches its pulp and paper with chlorine. And the definition of that means you're going to spew out dioxin. As a consequence, the Chicago Tribune has been very effective in detoxifying dioxin on its pages. They've done it regularly and they've done it often. So if the readers alone of the Chicago Tribune were to pick up about how nasty dioxin is, they would find very little on its pages, because the Chicago Tribune has its own vested interest in perpetuating the detoxification of dioxin. And this has been going on. Even the New York Times, at one point the New York Times was in the business of detoxifying dioxin. They, too, had a major pulp and paper mill that was using chlorine to bleach. And guess what? The Eskimos up in Canada, where the paper mill was, ended up suing the New York Times for $1.3 billion because dioxin does have nasty, mean effects. And one of those effects is, of course, breast cancer. But there are many other effects of being exposed to dioxin. So let's just say the Chlorine Chemical Council has found ready and willing people out there in the media to work with the Chemical Council, because they all have vested interest in the same thing. There are now some paper mills that are literally doing totally chlorine-free, and they are very proud of the fact that they have converted. And I think it's important for us to recognize that when we are consumers, we should ask for it's not just recycled paper, but it's totally chlorine-free paper that we should be asking for.
Leanne Chlorfine-Kasten is the author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. And we're going to come back to that interview in just a minute, but I did want to give out the phone number of the Bhopal Information Committee, which is based here in New York City. The number, if you'd like to reach them, if you'd like to support the victims in Bhopal, is 212-972-9877. That's 212-972-9877. 972-9877. And you're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. By the way, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. As we continue our conversation with Leanne Clorfine Kasten, author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. Leanne, let me ask you, why is it that the EPA refuses to ban toxic outlets like commercial incinerators that are clearly implicated in the cancer epidemic?
That's a very good question. Let me start by telling you that the EPA knows unequivocally that there are some chemical pollutants in the environment that directly cause breast cancer. As a matter of fact, in my book, I mention an EPA briefing where one of the staff scientists actually gave a complete list of all the organochlorines that were now found to be causative for breast cancer. So you've got knowledge on one hand, and then you have regulation on another. Isn't the EPA more aggressive? Because industry today is so connected to the EPA that industry, for the most part, can pretty much tell the EPA what it wants to do. So let's get into incineration. Incineration is the waste management choice for the EPA. And incineration, on one hand, has been identified by the EPA as one of the major causes of pollution in the world, one of the major causes of dioxin. Certainly, anytime you burn polyvinyl chloride, you're going to get dioxin. Anytime you burn any metal, you're going to get into the emissions a great deal of cadmium, mercury, and lead. All of that goes right up the stack and goes right into the Great Lakes, right into the waters of the ocean on the South and North Pole. But the EPA has a vested interest in perpetuating incineration as we understand it today. And this is despite the fact that there are alternatives out there, which I have written about, that are totally clean, that are closed circle, closed loop things, that manage to not burn the way incineration does, but manage through high heat process to completely change the chemical arrangement of the molecules so what you get at the end is far safer stuff. And these alternative technologies have been tested by Superfund. And guess what? The EPA refuses to acknowledge their existence because they don't have the clout. Now, we're talking about waste management, WMX. That has big clout. Mayor Daley's brother, Bill Daley, sits on one of the boards of a subsidiary of WMX. We are talking massive power here to continue controlling the dialogue. The EPA also allows for the spraying of 2,4-D anywhere. We're talking about the spraying of 2,4-D in pesticides and herbicides on farms, in homes. We've got 2,4-D being sprayed in every suburban backyard through all these chemical companies that promote lawn care. 2,4-D is the other half of Agent Orange. 2,4-D also has dioxin. It also has a number of other nasty chemicals that are xenoestrogens. And EPA allows the continued spraying of 2,4-D. Now, 2,4-D alone is not being sprayed, but what is being sprayed are chemical products that do contain 2,4-D. 2,4-D is a very effective herbicide. Your weeds are gone. And the question is, do we want our weeds to be gone, or do we want our children to be walking barefoot in healthy grass?
Again, we're talking to Leanne Chlorophene Kasten. Her new book is called Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. You mentioned William Daley, the brother of the current Chicago mayor, and William Daley is being talked about as a possible cabinet member, perhaps the Department of Housing and Urban Development or the Department of Transportation. He was the one who ran the Democratic National Convention this past August.
He did indeed, and he did it very effectively. We're talking about power, guys. Real power here.
Leanne, you mentioned dioxin, and dioxin is found in cigarettes. And in the last week, a report has also come out linking breast cancer to smoking. What have you found around that?
Actually, I found very little about cigarettes. Cigarettes are simply dangerous. And I say right up front, if you choose to smoke, then fundamentally, it's going to almost negate everything that I recommend in my book. Smoking is a major no-no. And anyone who really continues to smoke is going to do incalculable damage to her body, simply because of other factors as well. Smoking does create cancer. But I say that there are many things one can do, but the first thing you have to do is put your cigarette packs down. Then you can go on to do other things as a prevention. And I mentioned a great deal of those in my book. Cigarettes are something we just don't even, it's not even worth talking about. So much evidence is in about the carcinogenic properties of cigarettes.
Well, we talked about the EPA. What about the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which contend has cooperated with big business to allow poisonous treatments?
Well, it's not just poisonous treatments. There are three areas about the FDA that I'd like to discuss. One, let's talk about the silicone breast implants. FDA regulates that. At one point, three FDA scientists were sent to Dow Corning to investigate Dow Corning's study on the silicone. Now, these were animal studies. These were not done on humans, to be sure. But the Dow Corning studies clearly indicated that there were some problems with the animals, that the animals were getting sick after they were injected with the same substance that was put into the silicone breast implants. What did the FDA do at one point with these three scientists who came back and wrote a report suggesting that perhaps the silicone was not something we want to put into a human body? The FDA literally transferred these three scientists. In the meantime, the corporations that manufactured the silicone breast implants all had exactly the same problem. Their secret documents indicate this clearly above and beyond anything you could imagine. One, that the silicone did create problems, and two, unequivocally, the silicone was going to leak out of its casing. Every single manufacturer knew about the leak. They all knew. And that's one reason, by the way, that this major $4-point-something billion settlement was handed down early on for breast implant victims. They didn't have to show that they were sick. All they did was read these corporate memos, these very secret corporate memos. The memos were very indicting. So what we have are silicone breast manufacturers, including Dow Corning, that knew, one, that the stuff was a danger to the human body, and then two, knew that these dangers were going to leak throughout the body and it was going to affect a number of different organs. Let's talk about the bovine growth hormones. Monsanto makes bovine growth hormones. Bovine growth hormones have been shown to have something called an insulin growth factor, IGF-1. That alone has been shown to create breast cancer, okay? But Monsanto and its awesome power was allowed to put bovine growth hormones into the milk supply, and FDA did something even worse. They prevented, along with Monsanto, of course, they prevented the labeling of the milk so that when you buy milk, you have no idea, the public has no idea that their milk may or may not be laced with bovine growth hormones. And after a period of time, you just don't know what's in your milk, in your cottage cheese, in your cream, or even in your dairy products of any kind, or in your, let's say you buy prepared cake. You don't know what's in your prepared cake anymore because these bovine growth hormones are now mixed completely with all other milk products. We don't know what few dairies are holding out trying to keep their milk from being contaminated with these bovine growth hormones. And by the way, we didn't eat it. Bovine growth hormones are only supposed to accelerate the milk supply. So we don't even need it because there is already an abundance of milk in the popular stores, okay? We don't even need it. So Monsanto has really done a number on the rest of this population. And in terms of, let's say, alternative therapies, there we have an entire story all by itself. There may be alternative physicians out there who have maybe made some tiny breakthroughs for the treatment. We're never going to say of cure because cure is a little iffy. There isn't enough studies to say I found the cure. But they certainly have made major breakthroughs in the treatment of breast cancer that are non-toxic. And guess what? The FDA very often comes down on these alternative doctors, often raids their offices, confiscates their records. And there's one doctor down in Texas who had found wonderful results with the treatment of certain cancers. He's now on trial. He has been found to be, the FDA finally convinced a grand jury to put this guy on trial. And even this is a Texas doctor. The Texas Department of Health says it's not an issue of whether or not this doctor is curing people. It's really an issue of competition. They admitted it.
Leanne, as we wrap up, one of the things you write about that not a lot of people attempt to expose is what you call the cancer establishment.
Well, I think the best example would be the American Cancer Society. They are one of the biggest fundraising groups in the entire country. And they literally have databases so that locally, from our local ACS office, we are going to get all kinds of fundraising letters saying, do you know of somebody who's dying of breast cancer or dying of cancer in general? Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that you've got to contribute because we're on the cutting edge. Well, I can absolutely assure you the American Cancer Society is on the cutting edge of nothing. The cancer establishment is vigilant about having a little blacklist of those treatments that are fundamentally showing small little breakthroughs. And as soon as some physician has found the potential for a breakthrough where something is working either in the lab or on a patient, the ACS is vigilant about putting this treatment and that doctor on a blacklist, and there is an automatic no more funding. So what the ACS does is fundamentally gain enough money to continue the perpetuation of more and more studies on another chemotherapeutic drug with the major cancer establishments, Memorial Sloan Kettering, major cancer establishments that are doing major cancer research. But the cancer research almost always goes partly to the big drug companies so they can refine another chemotherapeutic drug. The American Cancer Society has a lockout of anything that might help, especially if it indeed is going to be a competition to the industry.
So you're talking about the American Cancer Society and also the big hospitals, the drug companies. Any other part of the cancer establishment?
Well, the National Cancer Institute claims these days that it is now beginning to do some studies on the environment. And they have, I have interviewed by phone several people who've said, yes, we're in the process of undertaking certain environmental studies. But it's way too soon because it takes several years to do these environmental studies to really come to any conclusions. I can only tell you that they have been doing some environmental studies in Stony Brook, which is in Long Island, where the women there are now 1 in 7. A lot of women are getting breast cancer up in Stony Brook.
This in Long Island, New York.
This is in Long Island, New York. And the women there are becoming very proactive because they're totally convinced it's a combination of the nuclear radiation out of the Stony Brook National Laboratory plus the DDT trucks that used to lumber up and down their streets during the 70s when everybody was using DDT before they found out how dangerous that was. And that synergistic mix between the two pollutants is causing a high level of breast cancer there and indeed in the Bay Area. So the National Cancer Institute is supposed to be doing some studies. I can already tell you several areas where these studies have already been found to be flawed. And so we're not even sure that there's going to be a great deal of integrity about how these studies are going to be conducted and what kind of findings they're going to be. But this is really a bit too soon to totally come to any conclusions about NCI. They're in the process, and we'll just have to give them some credit. The nuclear issue is just as valid as the organochlorine issue. And when we talk about exposure to nuclear radiation, there are some nuclear experts who say that 75% of all breast cancers alone are the cause of nuclear radiation, often overexposure to medical treatment. And there's a good study out about how the women, especially women who had tuberculosis, who are exposed to a great deal of x-rays early on, now are the direct descendants of breast cancer because these early x-rays were very powerful. There's also major stories about the higher incidence of breast cancer around Three Mile Island. There are stories about the younger women who were exposed to Hiroshima. The younger the woman, the earlier these women were exposed, the more potential they had for breast cancer. Those studies are very valid and haven't been widely publicized in America. We are protecting the nuclear power industry big time, and the nuclear power industry is a direct factor in the high incidence of breast cancer.
Leanne Clorfine-Kasten, why don't we end on the point of activism? What are people doing to fight cancer?
Okay, there's two ways of going. One is political, the other is personal. Of course, what we have to do is start making sure that we have as clean a food source as we can. And I'm going to urge everyone who's listening to, of course, eat your organic food. Stay away from red meat. I can't begin to tell you what's going on in commercial red meat today. And stay away from your milk products. There's a lot of toxins in the milk products because the connection to milk and meat is very high. But on a political level, we can do a lot of other things. The people who work for EPA, for example, are allowed immediately to go right off to work for the very corporations that they're supposed to be polluting. That has to stop. There has to be a way to stop that revolving door so that Joe Fink, whoever he is, who was a major factor in regulating Monsanto, doesn't have then the opportunity to go across the way and then work for the very corporation he was supposed to be regulating. I can promise you we're not going to find a lot of regulators doing a very good job if they think that they have a job out there in the big corporations that they were supposed to regulate. That's number one. Number two, we all talk about campaign finance reform. It's got to happen. Polluting corporations must not be able to control the dialogue. And number three, all that money that's being raised by all these good groups, whatever these good groups are, Why Me, etc., that money isn't just to go to more breast cancer research. That money must go to immediately identify more of the toxins that are poisoning our body. And we've got to find ways to get some of these good organizations to say, we're not going to just fund more breast cancer research. No, we don't need more funds for breast cancer research. We need more directed funds to identify environmental contaminants.
Leanne Clorfine-Kasten, author of Breast Cancer, Poisons, Profits, and Prevention. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0035. 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd like your comments on today's show. You can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's our comment line. 202-588-0999, extension 313. And I hope you still have ink in your pen, because I one more time wanted to give out the number of the Bhopal Information Committee on this 12th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. And that number here in New York is 212-972-9877. That's 212-972-9877. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Read my lips, no new taxes. I feel your pain. I am not a crook. What do all these famous lines have in common? I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!